It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay, so my brain does not work good.
You're just figuring this out now?
Well, this is a specific one.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday, Tuesday, I don't know. Recently, this week, I was behind a car. Man, so much of my inner monologue and inner turmoil comes from other people's bumper stickers. I saw a bumper sticker that said, "War is just terrorism with a bigger budget." Now, I believe I agree with the sentiment behind this, the idea that war is equally devastating, maybe even more so because of the scale, and is no more desirable or justified, and is something to work against just as much as we supposedly do for terrorism. This, I think, I agree with. The problem is that's the sentiment behind it. What was said was war is terrorism with a bigger budget. And I could not stop being like, you clearly don't know the definition of either of those words. Like, terrorism is a kind of war, and although it is frequently due to other factors on a smaller scale than what we think of as war, scale is not part of the definition. And it had me going to a bigger thing. I'm like, yeah, we all have been having difficulty with the definition of terrorism. Like, we call a lot of things terrorist that I'm like, I don't think they are. I think they're just sort of mass murderers, which is, but like, I spent a long time with this in my brain, and like, it bugged me. It didn't help that due to just circumstance, I was behind this car for quite a long ways. But like, this is a problem I have. Like, there's not, why does my brain care? I know what the bumper sticker was going for, and I agree with what the bumper sticker was going for. But I could barely think about that. I was very focused on this idea of like, shouldn't put that up. I might have an issue with bumper stickers.
Well, I mean, you've often said that you like to sort of vent generalized frustration by obsessing about something that doesn't really have any stakes and doesn't really matter. Like, it's a way to,
yeah,
it's a way to vent things that are, you know, actual frustration, but you're doing it in a way that there's no stakes.
But usually only if it's funny. And when it's just in my head, it's not funny.
Well, you're talking about it on the podcast. So obviously you think
years. It's a little entertaining. Well, yeah. Cause I was like, maybe I can get something else, but I wasn't thinking that at the time.
Okay.
I didn't come up with talking about this year until this morning.
Okay.
Years ago, on Scrubs, Roberta, a black woman, and Carla, Latina, are talking, and they are talking about weird things white people do, and they say bumper stickers. Why do white people put bumper stickers on their car? Like, I give a shit what you break for. They probably didn't say shit, but you get the idea. And that triggered something in me that I was like, why do people put, and I realized bumper stickers are like the tattoos of cars, because they're pretty much permanent. It's very hard to get them off. and usually nobody bothers to. And I like the theory of them, but every time I see one, I've bought many bumper stickers. I've never put it on my car. I'm just like, am I always going to want this? I don't know. And constantly I look at other cars and I'm like, really? And I'm, even ones I agree with, I'm just like, why are you essentially talking at me, a stranger behind you, about these views? What is happening? So I might just have a thing with bumper stickers. I also, and I can't take credit for this, I think several comedians have done it, I also have a thing with people who have a 13.1 on their sticker. When I was younger, half marathons weren't a thing.
I didn't know they were a thing now.
Yes. If you see somebody that says, has a sticker that says 13.1, that means they ran a half marathon. And people brag about running a half marathon. And don't get me wrong, I couldn't run one and wouldn't, and nobody should. But if they're a cool thing in and of themselves, they should have their own name rather than being half of another thing. Like, there's nothing else where you're like, I've successfully half. So, no, it's terrible. But I do want it because they have the thing, and it's sort of a ovoid shape, white background and black. It says 13.1, and then there's ones that say 26.2. So I want to get one that's just a random number that doesn't match anything. That's just like 18.4, and just have people wonder. That would be a good use of a bumper sticker.
Or, you know, you could measure what around the block is and find out exactly what fraction of an entire marathon that is. 0.02.
There we go. And then I have to change it. I'm going to need magnetic numbers or something. I will say that is a good reason to have a bumper sticker, is to absolutely fuck with the minds of everyone else. Not in a like rage way, not like I put a Trump sticker on there and everybody, but just like one where everybody's like, what does that mean? And the closest I've seen to that, and I did really like it, was a red bumper sticker that said, if this sticker is blue, you're going too fast. Nice. I like that one. I like that one a lot.
I mean, I think it...
No!
Sorry.
Hello, everyone!
Interrupted the hello, everyone.
Welcome to Magic Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast that starts when I say it starts.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 577.
All right, I'm sorry. What were you saying?
No, I was just saying that I was just going to say that I think bumper stickers are in a class of a lot of things that are related to people, you know, decorating. Well, putting patches on a jacket or wearing certain buttons or whatever, or, you know, anything that a person does to decorate, really, whatever they're out in public with, or even their cubicle, maybe at work, you know, what makes
I'll put bumper stickers up at work all the time.
Yeah. What makes people do that? I mean,
I'll tell you what makes people do that.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Did you have an answer? I assumed you were asking.
No, I am asking. I don't know.
All right. Well, then I can tell you because I know.
Okay.
It's what the internet does before the internet was doing it. It gives, well, in a situation like a cubicle, in a situation where it's in front of you, it may just be like a reminder to you each day. But in things in general, these things lend a sense of significance to one's opinions. Because that's what a bumper sticker is. I think this opinion or this joke or whatever is important enough that I want to put it somewhere so that people see it. And in fact, they have to see it when they're behind me on the street. This is that yard signs are a similar thing. And I have one of those. That might be some of it, is the bumper. Again, the permanence of the bumper sticker. I have a yard sign if suddenly I didn't want to say what that yard sign was saying, I could pull, bring it inside real fast.
I mean, I realize that bumper stickers are hard to remove, but they're far from like, that it's not that difficult. And you can also put another bumper sticker over it. So I'm not sure how permanent.
Which some people that that does crack me up when it's election season and I see somebody with a bumper sticker for one of the candidates, but that it's numbered for the previous one. I'm like, you couldn't even be bothered. It's the same candidate. You couldn't even be bothered. And I do still love that at the vacuum repair place, that dude has a Nixon Agnew bumper sticker put on a cork board there. And it is so old. It's a color that I'm confident it was not originally. And the edges are curling in and they're different colors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, some people just feel like advertising their personal opinions, I guess. I suppose there's an identity aspect, right? People like to, to assert their particular, whatever identity aspects of their identity, I guess. I don't know. When I was younger and I don't know how this happened or if this happens with young people generally, but I kind of got into the notion of wanting to collect various things, and maybe I'd collect a few of something, but then I'd get tired of it and collect something else.
Yeah.
But oftentimes the collection involved things that, well, like pins, because I do have a collection of pins, as you know, and that collection, you know, I don't just collect any pin. I collect pins that speak to me personally. So the collection itself says something about me personally. I never sat down and thought about that. Like, oh, I want to make some statement with pins. It's just, that's just what happened. You know, you buy a pins that you like. And so it ends up reflecting but your personality.
Deep down, it was aspirational because you hoped someday to wait tables at TGI Fridays.
Right. Put it on my flare. Is that flare. What they called it?
Yeah. Somewhere
office space.
I think in this house, somewhere in a house, maybe my parents, but I think it's in this house, is a small plastic container, probably about that tall, that wide. If you're listening on audio, too bad. And it contains all of my collections.
All of them.
Which are Battle Beasts, pins, and those little fluff ball things that had big feet, and the bottom would be a sticker, that were really big in the 80s and 90s. You may not remember them, but if you saw them, you'd know. And they'd have googly eyes. And I got a bunch of those because when I was in secondary school, like that was the thing that like teachers would give you and stuff. And so there were lots of different ones.
I collected
Smurfs.
There might
be more, but I just kind of put them all in one thing.
I collected Smurfs for a while and they were in a box.
And
my old Smurfs are in there.
Tiny porcelain animals that came in red rose tea. My mother would buy red rose tea. And if you bought a big bag or a big container of tea bags, there was inside a collectible porcelain animal figure. Hmm. I do not know why, except I do know why, because in our case, I was just super psyched to get them all the time. And I had my little collection. They're pretty cool little figures. And presumably my mother would never have been able to switch brands because I would not have allowed it.
There was a greeting card store in Knoxville that sold those little vinyl Smurf figurines.
Yeah, I have a couple of those.
Whenever I had money, I'd buy them.
I got as hand-me-downs. I didn't ever want them or collect them, but I ended up with them.
Pins I started collecting because I noticed men would wear like American flags and stuff in their lapel or whatever. And I thought, oh, you know, that's cool. I'd like to have a pin, but I wanted to have like an A&W Root Bear and things like that. That maybe people wouldn't notice, you know, only some people would notice this little pin. So that's why I started collecting them. And now I've got just lots of these pins that I'll probably never wear in a suit, but I bet I will. When I go to Phoenix, I'm going to have I'll have blazers that I'm going to be wearing. So maybe
just coated in.
Yeah. I should just cover it.
I've told you,
I'll just wear one little one right there.
Our Bozo the Clown, regionally, was a gentleman by the name of Ramblin' Rod.
I think
and he wasn't as a clown. He was just a dude. But he had this very big, I think based on the glimpses you could see, it was a brown polyester blazer. And it was coated in pins because kids would give them to him and things. And so it was just all pins all over. And that was very wacky fun for the time.
That'd be heavy, I think.
I would imagine.
Our guy was a ventriloquist named Dwayne Ellett. He had a little dog that he did a ventriloquist act with. Floppy. You probably heard of Floppy because if you've talked to people who are from central Iowa, besides myself, they might have mentioned him. Did I ever mention Floppy to you? Dwayne Ellett and Floppy?
You probably have. I'm vaguely insulted that you think I've ever talked to other people from central Iowa.
Okay, fine. Whatever.
I mean, come on.
All right, then.
I have my pride. If you're just joining us, I want to say this isn't what the show's like, but this is what the show's like. We have a hat is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People, at this point, basically two people are keeping us alive by writing into that email address with emails about whatever they want to say, questions they want to ask, things they want to discuss, deep, dark secrets they want to tell. Treasure maps they want to allude to, but then not share with us because they're greedy. Whatever. You know, not a lot of slurs. We appreciate that. But whatever they want, basically. The hat, magically, on its own, forwards the emails. It's magic. And to us. And then we read them and talk about them. Sometimes. This is a show.
Yep.
How's your week been? Did you have any good pancakes?
Yeah.
You had some bad potato pancakes.
No, they were good.
You let one go away.
I know. I let some of the pancakes too because they're filling. They're so rich.
Yes, but you let a whole pristine potato pancake go away. You could have had them pack that up.
Oh, I guess I could have. Why didn't I do that?
Because you hated them.
No, I didn't hate them. I actually liked them. I should have done that. Why didn't I do that?
They looked like heavily battered crab cakes.
No, they were just probably fried a slight bit too long potato pancakes, but they didn't taste burnt or anything. They tasted perfectly fine. I would have taken that home. I should have. Why didn't I do that?
You're a monster.
I was too enamored with my company, I suppose.
I think so. Most of our time spent there was me telling you about the new book and you just being in awe. So
yeah, I was.
We should really do this more often. Pancakes and sycophancy. I love it. Is sycophancy a word? It should be.
I don't know. I mean,
that's our first run at the title, pancakes and sycophancy. Not a doubt. I have started on the sequel to Odd Wings.
Oh, yeah, you said you were going to, so.
Tentatively titled Ofanim. As is the case with these things, the ideas are easier than the writing depth, but it has begun.
Good.
And actually, the way the work's balanced out this week, tomorrow, I should be able to put some good time into it. So that'll be nice. Yeah, and we had good talks. Again, if people want to donate like $1,000, you can get behind the pancakes, our sponsorship only podcast that we will record for all the deep, dirty stuff. William's into some weird shit, and you should check it out. Normally, I would just tell it all on here, but I want to monetize this. I want to monetize William's disconcerting proclivities. And you can help me with the money. So do it.
People would be very disappointed
to
hear our conversation freaky, after you said that.
Freaky as hell.
Look,
you have to sign a waiver that if you listen to it and you shit yourself, you can't sue us. It's intense.
Yeah. That's me, all right.
Also, he does a lot more voices when we're not on the podcast. His regular voice doesn't even sound like this. It's a much, much higher thing. Y'all remember Tiny Tim, the singer with the ukulele? It's like in that general area, but a little more. How do I put it? William has that thing. Usually, it's a special effect where, like when somebody's possessed by a demon or whatever, and you hear like multiple voices. That's just how William's voice sounds.
Yep. No special effects required.
No. But he works really hard to. If you go back and listen to the early episodes. He hasn't quite got it down yet. You can hear some of the original. So go check that out. It's pretty cool.
Maybe I am possessed. Who knows?
I mean, it would explain so much.
Yeah, it would.
So how was your week other than that, which was clearly the best part?
It's fine. I was going to do some writing this week myself, and I didn't really... I mean, some like... Not so much writing, but I was going to do some...
Mopping?
No, I've got some stories that I want to work on, but I can't start writing. I kind of have to do like world building type of stuff. I mean, I hate to call it that. That makes it sound more sophisticated than it really is, but I was going to do stuff like that and I never really got around to it. But I just did some, you know, various research type of things that interested me and was, I thought would be fun. I'm trying to just do things that I want to do for a while, because during that 10-week period where I have to do a whole bunch of stuff I don't particularly want to do, it's kind of nice to have had a break where I'm just, you know, focusing on something other than having to meet deadlines and having to, you know, read 300 pages in one go and things like that.
And your vacation's over after this week, right?
Well, the thing is, the class opens up over the weekend. I could wait. The classes don't technically start till Monday, but since the classes open up on the weekend, I could start early, and I probably will, just because being a little ahead of the game helps me feel better. Plus, I have to go to Phoenix during this quarter. Okay, so the way it works is I've got two classes like usual, but one of the classes, part of it's in Phoenix. That's what I'm taking, you know, I start the class for a few weeks and I go to Phoenix and the class continues in Phoenix. And then I come home and the class continues, but I'm taking a second class as usual. And that class does not care that I'm going to be in Phoenix. So I kind of need to be a week or two ahead in that class if Phoenix isn't going to totally mess up my schedule for that class. See what I mean?
So are you not going to attend class that week or... The non-Phoenix class, or are you going to take the laptop to Phoenix?
Yeah, I got to, you know, they're encouraging people when they go to Phoenix to go, well, you're going to be in class for part of the day, but you know, afterwards go have fun or whatever. Well, I can't do that because I've got a whole other class I'm taking that I've got to pay attention to. Now, if I work a week ahead, I might be able to just ignore that class that week, you know, but I don't know if I'll be able to do that.
Does this mean we might actually podcast from Phoenix?
Why would we do that?
Because we could.
Well, yes. I just got done explaining between whatever I have to do at Phoenix for one class and also do for the other class, because that class is still going on. I don't know if I'm going to have time to sit down and podcast.
Except if you were home, you'd still be doing whatever you had for both classes. And then you
right. Podcast. But if I was home, I wouldn't. The thing is, the classes that I have to take in Phoenix are going to take more time than it would take if I was just home taking classes.
All right. We'll do one ahead of time. We'll time travel. We've never podcasted from Arizona. You know, it would have been a first. I don't even know what time it is there, because the only real things I know about Arizona is they don't do daylight savings time and they hate Martin Luther King. So I lose track.
A mountain time, I think it is over there.
Yeah, but they don't do daylight savings, so it's all weird.
Huh.
Their time zone situation is odd. And okay. They hate Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, there's an old Applied Systems coworker over there that I might be able to see while I'm there, but I don't know for sure.
Wow. Would they be able to podcast?
I don't know. Probably. Probably.
Okay, so what else has been going on? You've been just screwing around this week. What you been doing?
Just that. I mean, I'm just trying to have some moments of calmness that hopefully will be, what do I want to say? Will be recreational, so to speak, so that when everything starts, I'm not going to feel like I didn't get a break at all. That's the worst part, is when, you know, you've got this 3-week break, but it's maybe so full of stuff that when this classes start again, well, it's like when I had surgery, and when classes started again, you know, I was in the hospital for a good portion of that 3 weeks and then other things. So it didn't feel like I had a break at all. And that was pretty terrible.
So. This is the thing. Every time you speak to the difficulties of getting this program, of doing this stuff, every time I'm like, I could solve that. Every time, instantly.
Yeah. How's
that? In fact, I do solve it. By not going back to school, you absolute lunatic.
You know,
you couldn't drag me back into the world of education.
But the thing is,
and I didn't even hate it, but I don't want any of that bullshit now.
And I know, and there are a lot of good things, and there are more good things than bad things. There really are.
You sound like people who have children. Ugh.
Well. That's true for kids too. It was far, far more good things than bad things about that. So, I can't complain about the bad things.
This is one of the most messed up things about the world. People are not jealous enough of my lifestyle. I think there needs to be more of that. By the way, do you notice anything different about this image?
The fan's not on.
Exactly. Trish figured out how to turn it off.
You didn't know how to turn it off.
It was it's the chain pull things. Sometimes the chain pull things get fucked up and it wouldn't work and the light wouldn't work. And so we were stuck with the fan on and the light on. And then I was like untwisting the light bulbs and then I broke one. So there's a shattered light bulb in there.
Oh my
gosh. So then it's just the fan going and you can't do the light at all. And I was like, I'm going to have to fix that one of these days. And I told Trish, I'm like, they don't work. And then she was in there one time. She's like, the fan still works. I can turn it off. You can turn it back on if you want. And I was like, hell no. Way easier to dust now.
Okay, well, are you going to try to convince me that your image is frozen and stuff now that the fan's not moving and it doesn't give you away?
It is possible.
Then watch the cat jump up and ruin it for you. I guess we'll see.
Trish walks by something.
Yeah. How was your week?
Pretty good.
I hear you went and had pancakes with a really interesting person.
Yes, I've had pancakes twice this week.
Yourself, I mean.
Okay. I have jumped into the modern world.
What's that?
It is what the kids are calling a Bluetooth speaker.
Oh.
So all day when I'm doing chores and things, I'm listening to music, I'm listening to my podcasts, etc., and I'm doing it via headphones. And that is not always comfortable. That is not always functional. If I have to like bend over a lot and stuff, and the headphones all go weird and stuff. And it gets warm. Also, if Trish is in the house or comes home or whatever, it can scare the shit out of me because I don't hear because I have the headphones on. And I used to put stuff on the TV and then I could sort of listen to music. But then I decided to get one of these and it was remarkably cheap. And now I can just listen to stuff all day and I don't have to have the crap on my head. It's great. I just tried it out today. So, and it's water resistant, so I can party in the rain. No, I've been watching a lot of movies, actually. I finally have gotten back into the groove at night of watching movies. All terrible, in case you're wondering.
I wasn't.
Last night we watched a Shudder original called Night's End, about a guy who's kind of shut in his apartment and it might be haunted and weird things happen. And it stars nobody you've ever heard of, and also Michael Shannon in a small part. So that was strange. It reminded me a lot of a different Shudder original film called Lucky that I discussed a while back, in that it's fine. It's not, I don't know that I'd recommend it, but I watched it and I was like, the people who made this movie are someday going to make really good movies. They're not doing it now, but it just has that vibe of like, it was decent budget, decent production, even decent sort of acting or everything, but like the writer, the director, the most of the people involved, it was just slightly more than they were able to handle.
Mm.
Also, it had no point, which is a problem with a horror movie. Your horror movie doesn't have to have a point, although almost always it should. But if it doesn't, you have to cover that with being interesting, with right. being really scary or really gory or really actiony or whatever. And this one is a lot of quiet and a lot of just conversations and things like that. And at the end, I was like, oh, crap, there was no point to any of this. Like, there was no message in this. There was nothing. That was ridiculous. So
action movies are the same. An action movie doesn't have to have any particular point, but it better have, it better yes. deliver in every other way.
But I would say that's not a good gamble with a horror movie in general. Even if you got a bunch of other stuff, you still kind of have a point, but you can get away with it. Just, yeah. But I saw a couple other real low budget, oldie timey shit things. One being
that's good.
What I believe Shudder referred to as regional horror, the Malatesta's Carnival of Blood. It was clearly made over a weekend at an amusement park that somebody let them use in the mid 70s. It was really pointless and like really poorly put together to the degree that not only were there situations where like we cut to a new scene and everybody's in a different place and I don't know why. Like, we cut to one where suddenly we're on a roller coaster and I'm like, how did you get here? You were imprisoned. Nobody talked about going on a roller coaster. There was no plot reason to go on a roller coaster. Now you're on a roller coaster. But it got worse. There are scenes where I saw people die. And then later, those same people were like doing stuff and nobody and like major characters. But here's the real weird thing. I was looking it up because it also had Hervé Villechaize in it, which was surprising and strange. I looked into it. A good half of the cast went on to have fairly long and prolific acting careers, including being in pretty well-known movies, usually in smaller roles. But like, a lot of them actually went on to really be actors. And everybody that didn't was in this movie and nothing else ever. So that was a little weird, but that's...
You're making me think of back when I was getting to know Iowa filmmakers in the late 2000, whatever. it came to my attention, my realization that a lot of the Iowa filmmakers were interested in horror. Like, that was the thing they wanted to do. That's the thing they did do. And it made me think that in the group of people that consists of film fans who think to themselves, I could do that, horror fans are disproportionately represented.
Yes. The horror genre as a whole is weird like that. It is a, well, first of all, if you want to get cool about it, it is a genre that lets you explore themes and ideas and motifs and visuals much more than a lot of other genres. But that's not, that's what people will tell you why they do it. The actual reasons, it is a lot, you can paper over a lot of other issues in horror, as long as you like scary or have interesting effects or something, like issues of acting or whatever. It would really stand out if you made a low budget amateur drama with like people who couldn't act. But with horror, you can sort of distract with a lot of things. And also historically, horror movies have some of the best return on investment.
Okay,
they are
so
a cheap and easy way to make money. That I don't know why, but it is.
In both of those things, you are describing horror in filmmaking in the same way that people describe romance in literature, right?
Yeah.
Like when you're first starting out to write books, they'll say, well, write romance because you can paper over a lot of things if, I don't know, the romance is good or the sex scenes are good, and you can make money. Both of those arguments are made for writing. Yes. So you're saying that horror is kind of the same thing for filmmaking.
Yes. However, and this is not jokes out of the room, I'm being deadly serious when I say this. Deadly probably wasn't the right word. It is also true in filmmaking for romance. We call it porn.
Well, okay.
No, but it's the same thing.
No, yeah.
Very little money, and you're guaranteed people are going to buy it up.
And it doesn't romance have to be good.
Exactly. Or at all. At all.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Does it have sex that I want? Yes. All right. Then I will buy it. And romance is essentially the version of that. But yeah, there's a similar kind of vibe. But yeah, and weirdly, the last part of that quadrant doesn't work though. Horror books are not particularly easy, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and not guaranteed to get a lot of return on investment, and I don't know what that's about. I guess everybody's just scared off by Stephen King and Dean Koontz, but I want to talk about the other movie because it pissed me off real bad.
Okay,
this is a Mario Bava film from 1971 called Bay of Blood. It has the distinction of being one of several films that some people consider to be the first ever slasher. Now, there are several films that various people consider to be the first ever slasher. Halloween, Black Christmas, etc. This one, of the films I know in that category, this one is the oldest. So if you consider this a slasher, it does win. It's sort of a giallo. I don't know if you're familiar with the term giallo. It's the real simple version is it's an Italian genre of crime film, of sort of noir criminal films. And there's a lot of overlap with horror, but there's never anything like supernatural in the giallo. And it's very popular. And I couldn't tell you the difference between a giallo versus just a crime film, but there probably is one. And it's technically one of those, but it is a slasher in that people are getting murdered one by one, and the mystery is who's doing it, all that stuff. So it might count. But it's not a good movie at all, at all, at all. Terrible. But standard terrible for Italian 70s film of this nature. The Countess is murdered. And we see who does it right off the bat. But then the dude who did it is murdered, and we don't see who did that. And then we pull back because the Countess owned this entire bay. And now the issue is who murdered her and who's going to inherit. And there's a lot of mystery about that because we have people visiting who seem to have ulterior motives and people who want to come in and wanted to come in and buy it for development reasons, but the Countess wouldn't sell to them. But now maybe whoever inherits it will sell. And all this stuff. And then we find a secret illegitimate children and shit like this. And so lots of, and also just random people who don't have any case in it. And one thing, I think just because we wanted to kill time and steam it up a little bit, we had four very groovy young people out to just have fun and joyride and stuff. And they fool around and you get a couple of sex scenes in there. And then they just sort of get murdered for seemingly no reason. But anyway, so it goes on like this, as one would, like, it was bad, but bad in a way I totally understand, until we get down to literally only two people still alive. It's husband and wife. The wife is the heir to the countess's husband, but not to the, she wasn't the countess. And she and her husband, who they do not get along at all, she's basically been browbeating him and bullying him into doing all these things. And then for terrible, in some cases, stupid reason, they have to kill off people so they can't tell what they know. And basically everybody ends up dying except these two and their children. Their children are in this movie for some reason. They have two kids. We know this because they came in a camper and they leave the two kids in the camper and drive off. That's it. The kids are just in the camper. And we have a little argument about it. If you listen to me, they'd be staying with their aunt, whatever. They're in the camper. We don't care about them. And in fact, the only time we see them again is in an effort to make a quick cut sort of exciting. We cut to what seems like an explosion. And it's just that the kids dropped something in the camper and they're trying to pick up the pieces. It's like some sort of doll or whatever. Does not matter. And we finish. And then the two people, and now they're getting along because the husband was man enough to murder things. And now they're like, oh, this could work out. This would be great. You know, maybe we're rekindling our marriage. And also we've murdered all these people, so we should leave for a while. But when we come back, we'll be rich. Great, right? Yeah, awesome. And then into frame comes a double-barreled shotgun. And you hear a small child say, Mommy, Daddy. And they look at the camera and are shot to death. And then you cut to the boy and girl child, who I'm going to say is about 7. And the boy is holding the shotgun. And the boy turns to the sister and says, they sure are good at playing dead, aren't they? And she says, yeah, let's go play in the bay. And then some very happy music starts, and we get over the end credits, seeing the kids just happily hiking to the bay and having fun and being like kids. Why did that happen? Why was that the end?
I don't know.
Do we have to create a new screenwriting thing called Chekhov's Children?
Maybe it's an Italian thing.
That's racist. But like, here's the thing. It's an incredibly forgettable movie that I can't forget, because I'm just like, why was that the end? Why was it like that? Why did these children have a shotgun? Why did they shoot their parents? Why do they know how to shoot a shotgun and don't understand death? Why?
Because they're neglected children. No, they don't. They're neglected by these people who are practically strangers to them. They probably get into all kinds of trouble when their parents aren't around, including finding the shotgun, learning how to shoot it and destroy things. I don't know. This is what happens to neglectful parents.
You know, this almost might work in my head. You might have solved it for me with this idea of it's a morality tale about parenting.
It is kind of, yeah. Yep.
And one thing I was very pleased about this movie. There were two characters, one named Frank, who was the real estate guy who was trying to get people to sign over, and another guy named Ventura, that was his last name, they called him by his last name, who owned a cabin on the bay and who apparently had orgies there. They referenced it. There were no orgies. And after quite a while, I eventually figured out they were the same guy. But because some people called him by his last name and some people called him by his first name, I didn't realize. And I absolutely love it when I cannot tell white guys apart in movies, because I always feel awful when I can't tell women or people of color apart in movies. And I feel like it is my own internalized racism and or sexism. And when I can't tell white guys, I'm like, nope, see, I'm just dumb. It's fine. So I was very happy when I was like, oh, those are the same guy. I had no idea. I thought they were two different dudes. I recently realized I have long been mixing up Michael Shannon, Michael C. Hall, and Anthony Michael Hall.
Mm.
Which is rough because they occupy very different spaces within acting. But if you put them side by side, you got to remember Anthony Michael Hall today, not Anthony Michael Hall in his prime when he was the skinny kid in all the 80s sex comedies. Anthony Michael Hall now, if you put them next to each other, I think they would look similarly related. But I got very confused for a while because Michael Shannon does a lot of really good stuff. And then Michael C. Hall is Dexter. And then Anthony Michael Hall is Anthony Michael Hall. So that was weird. All right, fine. We'll do a thing. You seem bored.
Bored?
Mm.
I don't really have anything to say about what you're talking about.
Mm.
I must have resting bored face.
This is why we can't have nice pancakes. This is from Jazz.
Mm.
Oh, get ready. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
To give you a little preview, the subject, just the subject, says historical fiction, comma, history as storyteller. I really like fiction that makes use of historical events such that you get curious about those events and wind up looking into them independently. For instance, I read this series that takes place during the reign of Alfred the Great and Edward the Elder. In the book, Alfred's daughter, Ethelred, Alfred's daughter, Bonnie, becomes the sovereign of Mercia after the death of her husband. And I was curious how that came to be, parentheses, a female sovereign, and whether the political machinations, I love that word, necessary to bring it about were similar in real life to the book, parentheses, they were. Conversely, I like history that's presented as a story. I'm reading this book now called The Jewel House, which has six different stories about scientific inquiry during the Renaissance and the way in which various elements of the society were involved. Parentheses, from glassmakers to midwives to merchants, a kind of ethnographic approach. Do you have any favorite texts that fall into either category that you'd recommend? Doesn't necessarily have to be a book, could also be a movie. Jazz.
There's a TV series called The Last Kingdom, and the final season covered this very area of history that she's talking about, where Ethelred was queen of Mercia
for a while. Bonnie and all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mercia is a real place.
Yeah.
I only know from somebody did a variant of the werewolf game that they packaged. It was called Wolves of Mercia, or as we like to call it, Wolves of Merca. I didn't know it was a real place.
Well, so that show, which was several seasons, and Vikings, which was several seasons, some people watch them kind of as companions to one another. Vikings takes place a little earlier, but Vikings is kind of from the Danes and Norwegian standpoint of that time period. And then Last Kingdom is set a little later, but it's also more from the Saxon perspective of it. And both shows take a lot of historical liberties. So I don't know if it's something most historical fiction people would like, although it does what Jazz is talking about. While you're watching it, you start to become interested on, well, what aspects are true and what aren't, you know? And so you go and look it up and you learn some new things. And I do enjoy that. I don't read any historical fiction really, except when I was reading Nathaniel Hawthorne, he often had short stories that were set in an historical context. And sometimes I could look things up and get an understanding of what he was, you know, talking about and what the setting really was and who the people were he was talking about. So that was often fun. I liked that. Movies, seems like I've seen a lot of historical fiction movies too, but it seems like the movies I've seen have a lot more license in them and they barely qualify because of that. But yeah, I like watching historical fiction, like television shows and stuff, and then looking things up. I do like that.
So what about Addie, you? Apparently.
What about you?
I find this very challenging. I am incredibly conflicted about this. On the one hand, I very much loathe fiction that purports to be based on true things and takes liberties, because to me it is super, like, people, this comes up less in historical fiction and more in biopics. Because then people get the impression they're supposed to get from the film about the person, and then they're like, actually, that's not what they were. That's not who they were. And of course, the one that has been really frustrating me, and I kind of went off on my sister about this other day, was fucking Bohemian Rhapsody. I saw Bohemian Rhapsody. I loved Bohemian Rhapsody. I felt like I had gained a new understanding on Freddie Mercury and Queen, and had learned a lot. And this film was given the seal of approval by the surviving members of Queen and everything. Pretty much every single plot point in that film did not happen. I felt so duped and so angry. And you can get this in a lot of historical fiction where they present things in a certain light. And it's like, that's not even remotely how that was. And I mean, to the same degree that you can get that in history, in interpretations of history, but in an academic context, the onus is on you to, you know, vet your sources and consider the information. When it's something for entertainment, it's just talking people into it. And I hate that people get these sort of bastardized forms. And anytime nowadays I see something based on a true story, I'm out by definition. If they say inspired by a true story, I'm like, okay, we all agree we're making shit up. And that's okay. But, see, I hate it. On the other hand, for example, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel has a reoccurring character of Lenny Bruce, the famous controversial comedian. And not only do I find him amazing as a character, it has caused me to look into him more and to realize that I was lumping him in with a group of other historical comedians to which he did not really fit. And that I actually think he's kind of fascinating. And I'm delving into him a great deal more now, specifically because of that show. And cool things like the show did a bit where he's on the Ed Sullivan Show. And they filmed it as though it was that. And thanks to the miracle of the internet, Trish and I found the actual footage of actual Lenny Bruce on the Ed Sullivan Show and could do a compare and contrast, which was amazing. And the truth is, they skipped a bunch of sections because it's a TV show and you don't spend too long. And also because some of the stuff, a little racist. But the bits that they had on the show were dead on. Word for word. And shot this. It was really cool. So I can appreciate this idea. And I love the idea I've always loved the idea of entertainment causing people to get more interested in topics, and history is a good example. So I guess I come out saying it is really cool that this power exists. I feel like this power is often not handled with as much care and responsibility as it should, and does a lot of harm in addition to good. I probably should not try and stake an opinion on which is more than the other.
But I do like
the idea.
Another TV series that we watched, The White Queen, that covers like part of the War of the Roses or whatever. I mean, again, you're watching this and you're thinking, did that really happen? And you look things up and you learn things. And it's kind of like what you're saying. It's so is this good or bad? Because it's good because we're learning what really happened, but it's bad because we're really only learning what really happened because we're doubting what we're seeing in a fictional portrayal. And we're right to doubt it because it didn't happen like that.
Yeah.
So you're like, I don't know if this is good or bad.
But another flip, and again, when you get into history, the further back we go, the more unsure we are.
That's right.
Too. And the less reliable on narrators. But another flip, One Night in Miami, which again, on Amazon, I highly recommend it to anyone if they have not seen it. And that one is very clear about here's history. And here's the bit we all know as public information. And then the night happened. And then here's what we all know happened after that. What we are about to show you is 100% fictional account of what might have happened in between that does make logical narrative sense to get us from the public part we know to the public part we know.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it becomes incredibly thought-provoking. And it also was one that made me follow up on those people because I knew some of those people. I didn't know some of those people. I thought I knew some of those people and had misconceptions about some of those people. And it was very fascinating, but it was very, very upfront. And the situation made it easier that they could say, like, here's the public. We're all knowing this thing. Then these four guys go into a hotel and then nobody knows what the fuck happened. But when they come out the next morning, here's all the shit that went down. So here's the thing. And that was fun, but that was very explicit about like what was real and what was not. And I appreciated that a lot. And it lets you think about like, how does that jibe with what I might've thought happened? And it's again, the line between reality and speculative fiction is very clear. And that is something I want more of.
Also, well, then you've got
damn good movie. It's
then
just
you've got
incredibly
like,
entertaining.
You've got things like Game of Thrones, which is pretty much completely based on the War of the Roses.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, okay, this is perfectly entertaining. In fact, it was one of the most popular television shows ever that didn't try to tell the story of the War of the Roses and add its own stuff to it. It just said, well, I'm going to, you know, it just told an original story and used some of that material, which, yeah, why don't you just do that?
that I am a huge fan of. But yeah. To Jazz's point, ideally, I mean, we're living in an era where it's not necessarily required anymore, but if you want, because if I'm George R. R. Martin in my head, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take the Rose of the War of the Roses and do this whole thing. But I don't want to make it too obvious because I want people to think I came up with this cool idea. But
okay, well, maybe. But
assuming you're not in that vein, in the credits, you should be like, if you found this compelling,
yeah, wouldn't
it
that be
was
cool?
Inspired by this real life thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
again,
yeah. That'd
you
be
need
cool.
To say like inspired by. I mean,
yeah.
Game of Thrones. Oh, Jesus Christ. I hope nobody's getting confused and thinking Game of Thrones is real, but too often this is a thing. And, but yeah, no, I love that. Well, and the ones you've seen where like, how many things have you seen that are actually Wizard of Oz? How many things have you seen that are actually Rashomon? And if you do it right, it can be really cool. Which reminds me, I was watching a Dark Corners review the other day for a movie called Satan's Blade that looks really, really bad, really bad, really bad. But what's fun is he's describing this whole thing and he's like, this is terrible. But if you take aside all the terrible parts and just look at the plot, this is Psycho.
Mm.
This is the plot of Psycho. And it's really kind of it's kind of interesting that it is. But if you follow the beats, this is exactly what happens in Psycho. But it has none of the things that made Psycho good. So I found that one kind of funny. And I do kind of enjoy that every once in a while. I'm like, oh, I love that moment when you're watching a wholly fictional thing and you're like, oh, they're just retelling blah, blah, blah. You know how like almost every romance now is apparently Romeo and Juliet. It's fucking everywhere.
I think the first time I was aware of fictionalized things based on real life where you're watching it and you have to stop and go, oh, wait a minute. Are they saying this really happened? And do I need to, you know, do I need to be critical, think critically about this? Was Backstairs at the White House. I don't know if you've even ever heard of that. There was a book called Backstairs at the White House. And I'm pretty sure it was historical fiction. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But there was a mini series, I think in late 70s, 1979. And my mom had the book, and that's the first time I remember kind of realizing that people could make fiction based on something that really happened. And also, while they're doing that, put stuff in there that they don't know if it really happened or definitely didn't really happen. That's the first time I remember kind of wondering how that worked. And I wasn't sure if Mom really liked it. We watched the miniseries and she read the book, and it was kind of a big deal in the house for a while. But I don't remember sitting down having a conversation with her about, well, Mom, how do you know? Because I wondered myself, how do you know what things happened and didn't happen in something like this? Because it wasn't fiction. Or, I mean, it was fiction, but it also seemed like it wasn't fiction. And if you recall, when I was young, that was a big deal to me, the difference between those two things. And if it was fiction, I didn't care. So I didn't quite know how to feel about it. Backstairs at the White House. You ever hear? You've never heard of that?
I feel like you made it up.
No, didn't make it up.
No, I haven't. I also, as we all know, I have an issue with fictionalized stories of people who are still alive. I always think that's weird, because if you don't have their involvement, it feels really ghoulish. And if you do have their involvement, I don't trust their bias. But when it comes to this kind of stuff, when it comes to history, existing stories, stuff, why are you doing it? If you are doing it because you have a fresh take on this story that's different somehow, okay. If you are doing it because you think this piece of history is important and needs to be told, okay. But make sure you're telling the history and not just what you think is a good story. And the third one, which I think is the most common, is, hey, there's already a cool story here. Half my work is done for me. In which case, fuck off. Make a new story. Not going to be the title of this episode. Probably should be. William's busy doing research now.
No, I just want to know that they call Backstairs at the White House an autobiographical novel. What does that mean?
It means that it was written about a person who's also the person who wrote it.
Okay. But is there a difference between an autobiography and an autobiographical novel?
I think
does novel mean there's fictional aspects to it?
Or? I think it might be based on a true story kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know for sure.
That's weird.
I would be more concerned about that. But again, I think you made it up and you're just pretending to look at a screen.
No, I didn't.
I had to,
you're making me doubt myself. So I had to look it up to make sure I wasn't, I mean, 1979, I don't, you know, I was 10 years old, but no, I remember exactly.
Julie Nolke just put out a video about the Mandela effect and she's talking to herself and she comes in and she's like, have you heard about the Mandela effect? And they start talking about things like Luke, I am your father, and Berenstain versus Berenstain Bears and all this stuff. And then one of them's like, yeah. And what about that one European country? You know, I never remember the name right. She's like, which one? She's like, I only can remember the wrong name. And Franz said, well, what's the wrong name? Cold Fishy Land. Like, what? It's like, yeah, it's Sweden. It turns out Sweden. We've spent all this time calling it Cold Fishy Land. And it turns out it's called Sweden. And then everyone's like, that's not, it's like, this is Mandela effect. It's like, no, that's not, that's just you being wrong. And she like calls somebody up and it turns out like everybody else has been doing this and calling it Cold Fishy Land the whole time, except the one woman. And she's like,
what? That's good. I like that. That's good.
And she's like, you want some cold fishy treats? It's like, those are Swedish berries. She looks just like, they are. I have the title. I don't know why. I've always called them cold fishy candy. I don't know what's happening.
That reminds me. Did you know that Will Smith with National Geographic made a documentary special called Welcome to Earth?
I did. And I loved that. I loved that so much. Because
I always think of you when I see it.
Yeah. I love, I'm like so racist, but also that's how it is in my brain. I can hear him saying it. I can absolutely hear him saying it wrong, and that's on me. I'm really sad that you said that, though, because my response to whatever you were about to say was, I don't pay attention to things Will Smith does, which is fairly accurate these days.
I like that question.
Once again, Jazz. Once again, as that was a good question. If you would have a good question, or just like, you may have noticed, Jazz just wanted to talk about shit, like not shit that any of the rest of us cared about, but she got it on the internet. So You can get it on the internet. Write in themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com and maybe you can feel good about yourself because you will have inspired intriguing discussion with us. More likely, I'm just going to mock you. But that's fun too, right? Right? Also, go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com. Tell us your views on historical fiction. I know a lot of you creepers out there have views on historical fiction because I have talked with you in person about them. Share them with the community. We all should know and have a good talk about it. We haven't been saying this, and I've been seeing it enough that I feel like it's a thing. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe, because apparently that's what you say
when you're on YouTube. Yeah.
And when it's a podcast, I'm supposed to say, leave us iTunes reviews, 5 stars. Oh. And 5 stars. Go buy our merch. Oh, shit, we don't have merch yet. Once we get merch, buy our merch. And listen again next week, or else.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.